Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, look, I'm on the road to a confidential location. I will be back on the air very soon, but today is a day to celebrate our triumph over evil. Some of the excellent articles that are appearing right now on MichaelSavage.com, some of the most brilliant minds of our generation, are now writing on various blogs, and I am finding them and linking them for your own edification. Please read them. I'll be back very shortly from a new location.
Savage.
Let us go to the callers then. KPRC in Houston, Texas. Peter, you're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hi, Doctor. Friends and I are having a discussion. I'd like to hear your opinion about it. It's Shakespeare. I know you're a lover of language. Opinion would mean a lot. Shakespeare, thine own self be true. A lot of people take that to mean that don't fool yourself. And a couple of us are also on the other side saying that actually what it means is that sometimes your own counsel and your own opinion is your best opinion. To thine own self, we'd like to hear your opinion.
To thine own self be true. Well, you're asking me what I think it means?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty self-evident what that means, which is no matter what people are saying to you, if you know that it's not right for you or not the truth, to thine own self be true. Listen to your own self. Now, does that mean, see, here's an interesting thing. An ultra-liberal would take that to mean it's licensed to do anything you want. But the question is, what is your true self? You can analyze that, meaning to thine own self. What is your own self? When I was younger, trying to understand what self was, I saw a series of boxes within boxes within boxes. Where is the self? Keep peeling away the onion skin, and what do you find at the center? And at a certain point, if you're an atheist, you find nothing at the center, and you get very frightened. It's only by finding God or refinding God, because God originally is in all of us, that you find where yourself lies. And once you find God, there are a set of rules, and then you have a self, and then you have a self to be true to. But without a core, without a self, you can lead to total anarchy. You can wind up doing anything with that so-called concept of self. I don't know if this is an answer, Peter. It was a little roundabout. Does it help in any way?
Absolutely.
Thank you. I know the phone's breaking up. That was not a bad soliloquy I just gave. I think the old bard would be proud of me. But remember what I just said. I think that should be captured. That's a very nice philosophical starting point for you to understand what that means. To thine own self be true. Does that mean follow any impulse you have? Why, that can't be what to thine own self be true means. You have an impulse to set a cat on fire? Is that yourself? Or is that some demonic impulse you have? Is that some out-of-control, repressed impulse? And what you'll wind up with is, you know, what they're doing in Menclaw, you know, having sex with a horse. Is that your own self? Or is that an evil impulse that was in somehow instilled into a person through a series of degradations of the soul? And first the loss of God, and then the soul implodes worse than Chernobyl. And into that vacuum enters the devil, if you want to put it in medieval theological terms. You want to put it in current psychological terms, you need to have a core self in order to be true to it. What is that core self? Where does it come from? How do you build a self? Isn't education about building a child's self? Think about this for a minute. I don't want to get into this too much, but I'll do it for another minute. When you have a child, you really don't know much about life as you should know till you raise a child. I got to tell you that right now. As intelligent, as kind, as brilliant as you might be, until you have seen a child born of your own, and until you have raised that child through thick and through thin, from dirty diapers to the diploma and beyond, day in and day out, worrying about their safety and their sanity, you don't really have a full understanding of what it is to be a full human. That's how I see it. And that's the way nature intended it to be. That doesn't mean there aren't brilliant, wonderful people who don't have children. Don't get me wrong. But there is another layer of difference between that and being a parent and sticking with the child. Anyone can be a parent. A dog can be a parent. Many, many men today are like dogs. They think because they impregnated a woman, they're a father. That doesn't make you a father, impregnating a woman. You know better than a dog. A father sticks with the child even if he doesn't want to. That's a father. That's a husband. That's the meaning of a husband. Anybody can run away and find another person to engage in that activity with. But a father sticks around. But anyway, I don't want to go there. So now how do you raise a child? What are you trying to do with a child? You're trying to teach him right from wrong? Of course you are. So where do you begin? You let him watch pornography? You let him smoke a joint? Well, of course not. Even a liberal would say, I'm not going to let my child smoke a joint when he's young. I'm not going to let a child watch pornography. Why? Because those are evil influences. What are they going to do to him? They're going to lead him astray. They're going to poison his mind. They're going to weaken his neurological system. So you feed him the good food. You give him the right water. And also, you got to give him the right education. And that means watch out what influences your child. Now you find out that a liberal who has a child who reaches a certain age becomes somewhat less liberal and somewhat more conservative. The old joke was, what do you call a liberal with two children? The answer is a Republican. Or you want to go a step further, what do you call a liberal with four children? I can even answer that one. Well, the old one was, you know, there's many different ways to put it. But until you have a child that you're raising, you don't really know the difference between liberalism and conservatism. It all comes down to the next generation and living for the next generation. See, that's the ultimate reason for living, is not for yourself. It's for the next generation. It's to give life. It's like the farmer sacrifices to raise the crop. He sacrifices by getting up in the morning. He sacrifices by working in the cold and working in the rain and working even in the winter. And then he sees the product of his labor in the form of the fruit or in the form of the wheat, which is, of course, the fruit of the grass. That's the product of his labor. He lived for his child, the crop. And that's the purpose of a human being's life. Now, of course, you can say, well, writing or painting or sculpting or creating is also a product of a life, and it is. But they're not mutually exclusive. You can raise children and write a book. You can raise children and do a radio show. You can do numerous things to raise children. But until you've had the fulfillment of seeing a child raised up, I don't think you really understand what it's all about, nor can you really understand why it's so important to support family values. If you don't have a family and you don't have children, what do you know about family values? Nothing. Nothing. All you can do is sneer at them and party on. Well, good for you. But that's not the reason to live, and that's not the way a society survives or goes forward. That's all. So what does to thine own self be true mean? It means many things. But it certainly doesn't mean following every impulse that may enter your psyche or attempt to control you or move you in a certain direction. It means the opposite of that. So there it is. I'm sorry to get so preachy on this, but I think it's useful every once in a while, don't you?
Savage.
Let's move it along here. What do you want to talk about on the Savage? Oh, my dream of a lodge. My dream of a lodge, because it's summer, you know, everyone I know is going somewhere. They're like children. They have a vacation, and I don't. Boo-hoo. I mean, I could have a vacation if I wanted. I could just take time off, but I have nowhere I really like to go. Say, well, why don't you like to go? A, I don't like crowds. B, I don't like the places I go to. I can't sleep, blah, blah, blah. So then I'm thinking, what would I really, really like? And I'm thinking what I'd like is a lodge that I own, mind you. Let's say 4,000 or 5,000 feet, alpine flora. It doesn't have to be 5,000 feet. It could be 6,000 feet. I would like it in the state of Washington. I'm fantasizing now. Somewhere on Mount Rainier, I would assume. I don't know if there's any such private lodge available, whether it's not all state-owned or federal. And I'd like to have it with an owner's room or dwelling on it as well. And I would have a retreat for myself that I'd go to. I'd broadcast from up there with a special broadcast studio, and the guests could watch me broadcast through, a partition, and they would enjoy the normal facilities of a lodge. The food would be great. The drinks, the bar would be great. And it would be conservatives only. I mean, I would make sure liberals couldn't get in there. I would exclude them. I wouldn't let them in. And anyone who behaves too liberally, we throw them out. That's all. Throw them out of the bar. I know a guy who owns a restaurant out in Inverness, California. I love this guy. He really knows what communism brings. He skied out of Czechoslovakia when the Soviets took it over in 1957. He was a world-class skier. So he went up over one of the mountains and skied into Austria and escaped. Well, he owns a lodge out there. I haven't seen him in years. A great man, wonderful man. I'll never forget. I went into his place, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I don't know when. Time moves on so quickly. And I had my dog. He has a wonderful little old lodge, and he cooks the food himself. And so I had my dog. I said, well, I guess I can't bring it in. He says, hey, you can bring it in. He says, he's better than most of the customers out here. Bring him in. So he said, I said, well, I'll keep him. He says, no, put him up on a stool. He said, here, give him a bowl of water on the bar. He didn't care about an inspector. So I started to like this guy, and I went back there once on a crowded Sunday in the winter, and he had a roaring fire, like a European inn. The food was, you know, bountiful and heavy, you know, high cholesterol, but delicious once in a while, the heavy, wonderful meats and this and that. So he used to walk around and talk to the customers and engage them in a bellowing voice. And he said to one of the guys who was there he didn't like, he said, well, what do you do for a living? You work for the Bank of America, he said. He said, get out of my restaurant. I don't want a usurer in here. He threw him out of the restaurant with his party of four people. He didn't care what the bill was. They had wine and dinners. He didn't want the payment. He said, well, let me pay. I don't want you to pay. I don't want your dirty money. He was that kind of guy. I loved him. I hope he's still living.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
WOR, Harold, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Okay, here I am. I'm back. So, it's New York. It's hot. It's sticky. I'm living on salads and water now. And all of a sudden, my mind wanders back to when I'm a little boy. I'm back in Brooklyn with my sister, my mother, my father, my aunt, my uncle. We're in my grandmother's house. It's hot. It's summertime in my grandmother's house. Nobody had AC. They didn't know what AC was. The windows are open. There's fans blowing everywhere. The woman is cooking. Six people are coming over. She's making food for 20. Little tiny apartment. Big table, food is coming out. What is she making? First, it's a big brisket full of heavy beef. It's hot.
Wait. You mean on a very hot day now? You're talking suffocating heat, but she's still making brisket.
Yes, it's hot. She's making brisket.
What's her her theory is what? If you're suffering from the heat, you need a good meal?
You have to eat. Absolutely.
That's how they thought. It was unbelievable. But you say, well, why do you need such a heavy meal? And what would the answer be? There was always some reason that you needed a heavy meal at all seasons, whether it was globally hot or globally cold. You always needed a heavy, greasy meal.
Not only a heavy, greasy meal, but you had to be heavy. If you were heavy, you were healthy. If you were thin, you were not healthy.
Yes, they'd ask you, what's the matter with you? I remember when I left home, I moved away for a number of years, and I moved out to Hawaii, went to the Fiji Islands. I came back, normal weight. They said, what's the matter with you? Are you sick?
Here's the one that I remember. She would make potatoes, mashed potatoes, but she would save the greasy drippings from the chicken fat.
Ugh.
She would put chicken fat in the potatoes, mash it up, and
did your father live a long life, or did he go by the way of Cedars-Sinai cardiac division?
Actually, that's an interesting story. You and I did my father's death one night on the radio. He made it to 91, very healthy, thank God.
Even though he ate that gravy?
Yes, absolutely. 91.
So what was his secret? Now top it off and tell me that he smoked.
No, my father actually did smoke, but he quit probably 35 years before he passed.
But how did he live to 92 eating greasy, heavy food?
Want to know? My father walked 5 miles a day every single day. The man was 85 years old. I used to fight with him. Dad, don't
okay, but Harold, here's the secret. You don't know where he was walking to and what he did when he got there.
Very good. No, I'm not.
It wasn't the walking. It was where he was going. Don't worry, I'm going for a walk. Where? Never mind, I need exercise. You don't know where he was going.
I didn't know where he was going. He was going to save money on the bread. Believe me, he'd walk 5 miles to save some money on the loaf of bread in Walbaum's or wherever in Key Food.
That's a funny story. God bless him. So your website is up finally. We had a little slowdown today. So you ate a heavy meal, and everyone lived long and happy anyway.
Yeah, it was a beautiful...
Let me ask you, after the meals in the family, wasn't it true that the men folk would sit on the couch gagging and opening their pants?
And fall asleep right away.
Holding their stomach and the pants would be open. I don't mean in a naughty way. They'd open the top button and lean. Oh, and the meal wasn't good. The women didn't feel that they did the right thing until the men were, like, hurting. They had to sit down and go, oh. Now, compare that to this generation. Hair plugs. Everyone's got a personal trainer. They're all in shape. They all drop dead younger anyway.
What I remember the most is my uncle. Every time after my uncle ate, every single time, my uncle would say, oh, I ate too much. Every time.
Yeah, that's a standard one. How about even now, if I go to dinner with family, I hear the same thing after we finish. Like, let's say we went to sushi last night. So we ate no shrimp. But we ate this, that, that. So, you know, it really was enough just to this. But the meal, you know, the main courses came anyway. We ordered and everyone eats them. We eat because it feels good to eat. Isn't that true?
Yes, we eat because it feels good to eat. It's also, in my culture, it's in bread. They stuffed it to me. Eat, 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 till I learned later on, I don't want to eat so much. It's enough.
Yes. Oh, no, you can control the eating, the pleasure through eating. There's a way to control that as well. It's all meant. You can drink more water, you know. Hey, thanks, Harold. Thanks for sharing on a hot day.
Savage.
Let's go to Chris now. Chris, what's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, this is Chris. I just wanted to let you know real quick, I haven't had my girlfriend for you. You actually are responsible in a way. I've been dating her for 7 months now, through the MySpace, which, I mean, MySpace ain't the best thing in the world.
Wow, how did you meet your girlfriend through me and MySpace? What was the connection?
She was browsing around one night, and through a girl who I knew up here in New York. She actually lives in Florida, but actually just moved up here now. We've been together 7 months. I have a very patriotic page, and she saw my Michael Savage book that I had pasted online on my page itself. And she
wow, that's unbelievably great. You know, that's an idea. Why doesn't everyone listening who has some kind of MySpace page looking for someone put up a picture of my book in their hand? I'll bet you immediately it becomes a symbol of people who find each other. And do it with my blessing. I don't need to make any money from it. You know, that's as simple as any method of immediately defining yourself.
Absolutely.
What a great idea. So what, you had a picture of the book on the page, she saw it and figured that you're politically compatible, and the next thing you know, you're in love.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Here's a special report with Jeff Kuhner exclusively for the Savage Nation.
Michael, this is one of the lead stories in this week's issue of InsightMag.com. What we have uncovered is as follows. Apparently, Congressman Henry Waxman, chairman of a very powerful House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, really one of the leading liberal anti-war Democrats in Congress, has been alleged, he's now been accused of really aiding and abetting the insurgents in Iraq, the Sunni insurgents in Iraq in particular. The person who's making this very explosive allegation is former retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Robert Patterson, prominent conservative, best-selling author, someone who carried the nuclear missile codes for President Clinton. And what Buzz Patterson says in his latest book, The Left's Campaign to Destroy Our Military and Lose the War on Terror, is that Code Pink, a prominent anti-war group, a couple years ago went down into the city of Fallujah at the very time that U.S. forces were battling al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein loyalists, and that they brought with them $600,000 worth of cash and supplies.
What?
Now, what Code Pink was telling everybody at the time was that this was humanitarian aid, that this was just there to help the civilians. What Buzz Patterson has uncovered in his book is that apparently those, in fact, were it was cash, it was supplies that were not given for humanitarian aid, but in fact were given directly to the terrorist insurgents who were murdering and killing American soldiers right at the time. The person who facilitated that transfer of cash and supplies to Fallujah was Congressman Henry Waxman. He wrote the letter that allowed Code Pink to go into Fallujah and to be able then to distribute the money and supplies to the terrorists. The $64,000 question, and this is something we're not able to get out of Congressman Waxman's office because they haven't, they've been refusing to speak to us or to give comment to us, is did Henry Waxman know that Code Pink was going in there to help Iraqi insurgents? Did he deliberately, conscientiously write that letter, giving, opening the doors for that group to go there to help kill American soldiers? Or did he truly believe it was simply humanitarian aid? Michael, even if this was something that he did unknowingly, the point of the matter is, by helping Code Pink go into Fallujah, Henry Waxman clearly aided and abetted terrorists who were killing the killing American soldiers. As Buzz Patterson says in his book, if this isn't treason, then nothing is.
My God.
And not only that, Michael, what we have found out is that when Code Pink, its activities in Iraq, they also established an office in Baghdad. And in that office, its co-founder, Medea Benjamin, who's a prominent anti-war activist, very hardline leftist, a Bush hater if there ever was one, she was there in Baghdad, and she opened up an office encouraging U.S. soldiers to desert the war, to leave the field and to desert and to come back home. Michael, what you're now seeing here, I believe, is a crossing of the line. I think this is a watershed moment in the culture wars of the United States. It is one thing to oppose the war in Iraq. It is one thing to say you don't believe it's in America's interest to be there. It is something very different for an anti-war group to go down into Iraq and to give supplies, to give money, to give moral support to murdering thugs who are not just killing Americans, they are killing Iraqis, they're killing children, they're beheading women, they're beheading men. Michael, this is, I believe, an absolute scandal. It is beyond outrageous. And for a prominent member of Congress who likes to pose literally as somebody who is, you know, the most moral man on earth, who's going to bring George Bush down and all the corrupt Republicans down, and the chairman of the government committee, or the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, for this man to be even associated with these kind of literally treasonous left-wingers, these treasonous America haters, he has a lot to answer for, and I hope his constituents hold him accountable, because, Michael, this one he has to explain.
What kind of government is this?
Well, Michael, this is the question I've been trying to get a lot of Republicans to answer, and nobody really wants to answer it so far, which is, you know, this is a man who's been a gadfly to the administration. He's led one, literally one investigation after another. Everything is a scandal with this guy. He wants the president censored. He claims that they misused the National Drug Office control policy to get 18 Republican members elected in 2006. I mean, he just finds one scandal after another, and yet here he is allegedly involved in maybe the greatest scandal. In terms of, you want to talk about subversion of our of the Constitution, you want to talk about subverting the country's national self-interest and the country's national security, to me there is nothing more blatant than literally directly aiding and abetting terrorists who are killing Americans and then who want to come here into America, you know, from Iraq and kill more Americans. You know, and so far the Republicans have been very reluctant to confront him. They don't know how to deal with the liberals right now in Congress. A lot of Republicans are divided on the Iraq war. They feel that President Bush's support is hemorrhaging. A lot of them now, people like Olympia Snowe, people like Senator Richard Lugar, you can run down the whole line, are now looking to jump ship and bail, and they're not looking to play offense, they're looking to play defense. And so you have people like Henry Waxman, but it's not just Henry Waxman. It's people like Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Hillary Clinton, they are now going on offense. And, you know, Michael, as we point out in other stories in this week's issue of Insight, they're now pushing for impeachment. A lot of these Democrats now want to see Bush and Cheney impeached. So you now have an increasingly galvanized, effective, emboldened Democratic Party on Capitol Hill. They sense blood in the water. They believe, Michael, that this is the 1970s all over again, that they can bring a defeat as they did in Vietnam, they can drive us out of Iraq, they can impeach a president, and this will be Watergate, and literally post-Watergate all over again, where the Democrats will control both houses of Congress, they will control the presidency, and literally you will see a new age for America. They believe they can relive their youth. And this is what you're seeing right now on Capitol Hill.
That's right. Liberalism is a mental disorder.
Oh, no, really. I mean, that's classic what it is. I mean, really, that's exactly what it is. A lot of these people were baby boomers who came of age in the 1960s in the anti-war movement, and they believe that literally history is repeating itself again. And to me, what is uncanny is, you know, in some ways there is a parallel, because we won that war in Vietnam. I mean, contrary to all the spin and the myths propagated by the liberal media elite, nobody can name me one battle that American troops lost in Vietnam, because we didn't. We never lost a battle in Vietnam. We left in 1973. We had emboldened and supported the Vietnamization process in South Vietnam. They had been functioning on their own. The only thing that cost us Vietnam was we pulled the plug on air support and on logistical supply during the Watergate proceedings with Nixon. The Democrats refused to aid South Vietnam, and they were overrun by the communists. We never lost Vietnam. The politicians lost Vietnam. The U.S. military never lost in Vietnam. And that's exactly what's going to happen in Iraq. We have not lost one battle in Iraq. We cannot lose in Iraq. They don't have the manpower, the military firepower to beat us. The only way we can lose is if they pull the plug on us. And that's exactly what they want to do. The left has done one thing. They have it down to an art form. Transform military victories into political defeats. That's their game plan, and that's what they're doing again.
Jeff, thanks for that update.
Michael, thanks so much.
Savage. Someone once said this to me, a professor back in 1970. He said, you know, you're the only person I've ever met. He said, it's astonishing that you can function. He says, you have no barrier between your conscious and your subconscious. You actually function with both at once. So I said, and? So? What's wrong with that? In other words, I've plumbed my depth sufficiently through self-analysis to know who I am, and I'm not ashamed of it. What do I got to hide? I'm not like most people. I mean, well, what's there to hide? When everything I see isn't so pretty. But that's life, you know? Out of the muck, a lotus will grow. We all come from the muck, and we all go back to the muck. We come from the muck. We go back to the muck. What more do you need to know? None of us are demigods. None of us are God. Once you understand that we arise from a smelly ether called the swamp of life, and that is what we go back to, the rest is very easy. Then you stop worrying about if you have an extra little flab on your stomach and a gray hair and a mole on your face, and you suddenly accept yourself for what you are. Then you can wear an undershirt and look at yourself in the mirror and say, that's it, thank God I'm alive. And I got two legs and two arms and two lungs and a beating heart. What more do I need? I got to look like a bicycle rider who takes cocaine? Oh, God, what am I talking about? Why are you listening to me? I'm going up and down the scale here. I'm playing the scales for you on the Savage Nation. No, I'm a little upset because I opened a letter just now, a personal letter. I shouldn't have done it during the show. I got all my mail and I opened one from a relative. It's a shocker. It's a picture of my late father from a year before he died. Photo of daddy enclosed. Your mother kept it in her bag till she did. No, I never saw this picture. He looked healthy. He shouldn't have died this young. I'm older than he was and he died. It's eerie. Yeah, I thank God Oscar the cat isn't here. He's liable to curl up next to me and it will be all, be all over. He was in better shape than I am. Are you kidding me? And he died anyway? Not a gray hair on his head. And thin? I put on weight, I got gray hair, and I'm still kicking. Go figure it out. You know how many guys died in their 30s that I knew who were runners? Huffing and puffing with watches, and they'd vitamin every minute. They looked at their watch. They wouldn't touch this, and they ate perfect. They dropped dead like flies. I don't say don't exercise, but no man is made to run like an Ethiopian bee picker day and night. You're not living in Ethiopia at 12,000 feet. That's why they win these races everywhere. That's where they run at high altitudes. You don't. Every year's a few blowouts here with the San Francisco, what do they call it? Marathon. The marathon. Every year they got someone dropping dead before the finish line. If you want to run, go run. Enjoy yourself. This too shall pass. I have a whole different theory of exercise at a certain point in your life. Now, remember, I wrote the book on nutrition, and I also exercise moderately, but the key word is moderately. this excessive, like you're on a treadmill, heart attackville. It's worse than sitting in front of a television and eating Doritos. And I'm telling you, no human being has made the, you ever see old men running like that? It's insanity, total insanity. Show me in nature where a man runs like that after the age of 40, unless he's being chased by a predator who wants to burn his house down. Nobody runs like that if they don't have to. What did the great American writer say? Mark Twain. He said, "I get all my exercise going to the funerals of my more athletic friends." It was funny. It worked for him. It worked. I'm sure if he ran, he would have been dead at 30. I'll never forget when I stopped running. The day. Are you interested in any of this, or do you want to talk about home invasion? I'm in a sweat from the whole story already. I ate nuts during the break. I got this picture. Now I'm having palpitations. I think I'll have a pizza for dinner tonight and beer. Nah, I think tonight I'm going to drive into the city. I'm not in the city. I'm not in San Francisco now. I'm out in the suburban location, one of my Arafatian houses. I have many locations. I don't know where I'm going to be the next night. That way, if anyone, they don't know where I'm going to, because I don't know where I'm going to broadcast from or where I'm going to sleep. I have several locations. I have to. That's what the liberals are today. I have to watch out for them because they're all psychopaths. Every last one of them belongs in a mental hospital. Or in a straitjacket. That's all. Forget it. I don't want to go into bashing liberals. It's been done too often, and I did it better than anybody else. Oh, let's move on. Sunni Shiites, not interested. I don't ever want to know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite. I'm not interested. I don't care about them. They're obsessed with themselves, and the media, who never told you once what Judaism was or what Christianity was, except once a year around Christmas, now they're an expert. Every day they give you an expert story on Islam. The same liberals. Isn't it interesting how they love Islam? They can't get enough of it. They're experts in the Sunni sect, the Shia sect. Now you see, I'm talking. He looked good. Look at this. I can't get it out of my head. I shouldn't have looked at these pictures. He was, God bless him. A lot of good it did him. The white, black hair, thin, kept in shape, and dead. And what about Winston Churchill? He sat in the bathtub drinking brandy and smoking cigars. It hurt him? Could you picture him running around, let's say, England during World War II, saying, I got to do a stress break now? Our president, all our NBA-like leaders, they all run, they're in perfect shape, and they can't think. He sat with a brandy and a cigar in a bathtub. He was able to lead Britain through the darkest days of World War II. How is that? How's that possible? You know, maybe that would be a theory for George Bush to straighten the country out. Stop with the sobriety, have a drink, and sit in the bathtub with a cigar. Maybe you can save the country. You'll have some insights. Like, take the handcuffs off the men, number one, and tell the liberals to go to hell, number two. That might save America. KNEW, San Fran. What? Someone from England sent me a new one. I use San Francisco, San Francisco. San Fran. She called us something else. A friend from somewhere. A long email. San Fran. I can't remember why I bring it up.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
I have a couple of things I want to tell you about. A, how I just survived coffee at a Starbucks in San Francisco. This took the patience of Job. Before the show, I went down. I do almost everything myself to know what Life 101 really is. I could hire someone. But, you know, I figured out it's actually good for me to. Otherwise, I wind up like George Bush Sr. Wow, golly be gee, that's a checkout stand in a supermarket. Whoa, cool. Wow, that's a laser. Ooh. No, I got to go buy coffee and see how you people suffer, fools, ungladly. Just before the show, I ran out for a Starbucks. Now, I survived Starbucks. It's not easy, I got to tell you. I'm in a rush. It's like, you know, 20 minutes before the show. I should have sent someone out for it, but I tend to work alone. I like to be alone. I ran out for a coffee. I figured I could sneak in at that time, though. And bingo, I hit three people ahead of me, and a girl jumps in ahead of me. And the three people, everyone's cute. And what kind of the sweet do you want? I think, and there were men, and everyone was with a cute, no one would say, just give me the blueberry cake or give me the oatmeal cookie. Everything was like with a cutesy thing. Oh, I think I'll have the, Oh, you're such a sweetie pie. All right, so I had to live through them. The feet were curling up inside the shoe on that one. I don't say anything. So now there's only one in front of me. And did I hit the lottery with her? I figured she looked normal. She was going to say, coffee and get out of there. But no, here it was. I'll have a double grande latte espresso decaf with extra low-fat cream and extra foam and a soy blast sprinkle, please. I'm not making this up. I said, no. Now I'm getting enraged inside. My eyes are already searching to take it out on something. Again, she repeated. The guy didn't even know what she said. That's right. And a sweet voice on it. I'll have a double grande latte espresso decaf with extra low-fat cream and extra foam and a soy blast sprinkle, please. And then, to top it off, after the guy makes it first, she pulls out a coupon, a transgender discount. In San Francisco, the mayor gives out transgender discount coupons. Insane societies, they used to give out discount coupons to war veterans. In this city, they give them out to transgendered people. That's right. In San Francisco, TGIF has a new meaning. That's right. TGIF has a new meaning in San Francisco. Transgenders, it's Friday. Prior to surviving Starbucks, I did something even more threatening to my psyche, which was I went to Fisherman's. I got into the city early, so I went by bicycle to Fisherman's Wharf. I haven't been there for a year. I stopped going for about a year. I went once this year. And I went and had a bowl of clam chowder soup in some joint near the water. The guy gave me a bowl of cornstarch with the droppings of a clam in it. I don't know how they didn't get arrested for this. How do they sell this on Fisherman's Wharf? Then the nerve of this mutt, he says to me, do you want a cup or a bowl? I was in a rush. I was on the phone. I said, give me a cup. The cup was $5.95. A bowl would have been a dollar more. I paid and left. I didn't care. But the point was the soup was garbage. How do they serve this to tourists? With it was like cornstarch with the essence of a squeezed clam in it? But the schmucks don't know what they're eating. That's why they call it the Redneck Riviera. You should see the blimps walking around down there. They walk into cars. They walk in front of cable cars like blimps floating around.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, look, I'm on the road to a confidential location. I will be back on the air very soon, but today is a day to celebrate our triumph over evil. Some of the excellent articles that are appearing right now on MichaelSavage.com, some of the most brilliant minds of our generation, are now writing on various blogs, and I am finding them and linking them for your own edification. Please read them. I'll be back very shortly from a new location.
Savage.
So let me tell you what happened. Last night I went to dinner with a friend who was a very successful film producer. In fact, he last year had the largest grossing film of 2006. Just so you understand, he's not an unknown. He's quite a known quantity. He's also a very, very big conservative and has been all of his life. And he's certifiably my friend. So I brought him a copy of an outline and a chapter of an autobiography that I started to write 6 months ago and I put on a shelf. And I said, look, this is the basis for the movie that we're going to do. And I said, I've got tons of archival footage in video of the events we put on, the Saving the Real Private Ryan, Name Him and Shame Him, Try Him and Fry Him. I got some amazing video. His eyes lit up. He said, that's gold. I said, I also have some great Super 8 footage from the years in the Fiji Islands when the kids were babies, with the Fijian people and the collecting the plants. He said, that's unbelievably popular today. I said, it's a straight-out documentary. I said, if Michael Moorhead can make fraudulent movies about health care in Cuba when we all know it was in a feed hospital for Fidel Castro and his murderous hordes, and the left will go to see that. Well, I'm sure that the center-right people, of whom there are quite a few in this country, would like to see the Michael Savage story in the movie theaters. They want to see it on the screen. And it won't gross as much as The Passion of Jesus, I can guarantee you, but it will probably be in the $50 to $100 million range in the overall gross. So you say, well, how are you going to get a movie like that distributed? The answer is simply, people in the movies, although they hate conservatism, do not control all of the distribution in the movie business. In fact, there are some conservatives who own quite a few screens. And all I need are 500 theaters to do this in. So to make a long story short, we're going ahead with it, okay? So now let's get down to what I'm going to do with you today, if you want, on the show, which is stories. So what's going to be in the movie? What are the opening scenes? What are some of the scenes? Well, I have a concept, which I'm not going to give away for the movie itself, of how to do this, where I will play me now telling the story of my life with flashbacks. Basically, that's it, because I want to be in it and tell the story. That's what you want to see, is me now. But there's a me then, and there's a me now and a me then. So I want to talk about some of the childhood stories. Those will be staged. There we're going to get actors for some of those scenes. So, for example, if I said I want to stage Fat Al's Tuna, what if I want to open the movie with Dead Man's Pants? Now, many of you are new listeners, and you like my politics, but you don't know what these stories are about. I'll tell you Dead Man's Pants right now, and then I'll take your requests for stories, your favorite stories from this program, at 1-800-449-8255. I'm not in a great mood, so my ability to tell a story may not be as good as it is some days, okay? So bear with me. But let me tell you Dead Man's Pants. Oh, God, I wish I had the narrative with me, which I wrote so much better than I could. It may be right. It's actually, most of these stories are in The Enemy Within. At least a good portion of them are in here. Drew, see if you can find Dead Man's Pants. I don't know if I can find it in here, because I'd rather read it right now than tell it. I'll try to tell it to the best way. It opens with Harry speeding and almost killing us in the cab. Here it is. Got it. I got it. Dead Man's Pants, page 7 of The Enemy Within. So settle back for a summer story, because here it comes. Okay. Growing up in the Bronx as I did, the man-child in the promised land, I didn't have many of the luxuries most kids with their hat on backwards take for granted today. You see, my father was a first-generation immigrant. He worked his fingers to the bone. We simply didn't have the money to afford more than the basics. So, as you might expect, I cherished and took care of the things I had. As a kid, I'd line up my shoes under my bed at night neat, like in the military. I made sure they were polished, too. I'm sure some shrink today would say I suffered from ADD or some obsessive-compulsive disorder and should have been put on an immediate regimen of Ritalin. I wonder what a shrink would say about the fact that through most of my youth I wore secondhand pants from Dead Men. I'm absolutely serious about this. Many of the pants I wore as a preteen came off of stiffs and were cut down to fit me. Don't get me wrong, my father was a good man. He ran a small antique store with mostly 19th century stuff in it. On the side, at least in the beginning, he sold used goods as well. A man's got to do what a man's got to do to make ends meet, right? Occasionally, Dad would go to an auction where a man had died and buy the entire estate, the clocks, the dishes, the mirrors, whatever the man had, the pants, the shirts, the whole deal. You get the picture? Well, back at the store at night, as he was sorting through the stuff for resale, my father would take a closer look at a certain suit or two. Once he got a hot shaft remarks from a dead man, now what's he going to do with it? Toss it in the garbage like they do today? In those days, it wasn't in him to throw out a good worsted fabric. Instead, he brought home the pants to me. I remember my father showing them to me, like the head tailor at Nordstrom's department store. He'd say, "Now, Michael, get a good look at the fabric. I wanted to vomit. I got a migraine because I knew what was coming. Take a look at the quality of this fabric. He's working me like a salesman. He's unrolling the pants on the bed. I can see it to this day. He unrolls them like he's selling me a bolt of hand-woven cloth. He would say, you can't get fabric like this anymore. I wanted to say, of course not, Dad. They only sell stuff like that for men who died. You know, it was like special clothing for the undertaker. Even if I had said something, that wouldn't have changed anything. He'd go downtown, and the pants would come back fit for me, you know, without the legs taken improperly. They ended up like baggy, like a pair of Charlie Chaplin's pants. Even if they had fit me properly, there was something repugnant about the whole idea. The whole idea. Now, here's the connection. Today, almost daily, the leftists from both political parties come into our homes peddling some new entitlement program or some new right or new educational initiative. As they roll out their one-world socialist ideas that went out of fashion decades ago, we feel nauseated. Why? These posers are offering us nothing more than dead man's pants. Ideas that history has demonstrated don't work. And I'll pause right there. And that is a story that I wanted to begin with. And that should be in the movie. That might be an opening scene, just a state. I wouldn't be in that one. We get an actor, a kid with dark eyes and, you know, tussled brown hair and the dad in the store. That could be filmed for, you know, not a fortune. I'm going to use unknown actors for this movie, by the way. I don't need a famous actor. I have an idea for a screenwriter who I'm going to approach, who I'm going to ask to do it for, and he'll have to do it under a pseudonym, and his name won't be Ned Allen. He's a famous screenwriter who might be conservative enough to write this, but he could never do it under his real name because he'd be boycotted by the Prius drivers at the Creative Artists Agency, I think.
Savage.
When I tell you these stories, some of them will wind up in the movie, and I hope the movie does get done. There's no reason it shouldn't. It's a matter of time and energy and money. And so, you know, and to get enough people involved, good people in this production, it will be in a theater in your lifetime, hopefully before the election. Because, frankly, if I can get this movie out just before the election, and the emphasis is on borders, language, and culture, as through the struggles of one man and what he overcame and how the social engineers of the left almost destroyed him, I think it will swing a lot of voters in the direction of saving this country and moving them in the right direction. And that's really what I have in mind. The timing is going to be everything here. So what we're talking about right now is what scenes you remember, what stories I've told over the years that you like, that you would like to see filmed and come to life, I'll tell you the story. So WOR New York City, Ramon, go ahead, please. Welcome.
Hi, Michael, two great stories come to mind because they resonate with me. The first one is, when you're talking about getting stuck in the basement polishing the statues with Brasso, and you would be able to explain by your father how the statues were judged by the quality of the fingers. Remember that statue by you getting stuck having to polish them in the basement?
Yes, but one correction. We didn't use Brasso. I used cyanide solution, which is a whole story unto itself. I mean, it's toxic. It would not be permitted today, but that's a separate issue. Yes, and my dad taught me that you can judge the quality of the artist by the fingers and by the toes, and he was 1,000% correct, wasn't he?
Great story, absolutely. The second one is driving to work with your dad, and he wouldn't let you listen to the radio, and my dad did the same thing to me. He was
I was sitting grimly in his car in those cold, horrible days going down to the store on Saturday when all I did was want to hang out with my friends. And all I would try to do is, like, you're sitting in this car, the air was so thick you could cut it because the poor guy had worries, you know, worries about whatever. And he wanted the silence of the car. Meanwhile, the sun dummy is sitting there. And I wanted a little rock and roll music. I'd hit the button. He'd say, "No music. Is that what you got?"
He cut my hand off, too. He's like, "Be quiet. We're going to work." And I was like, "We're not."
That's right. In other words, when you're going to work, there's no time for levity on the way to the pyramid. If you're going to pull rocks up that pyramid, you can't have any fun on the way to the building site. Those old guys really had a way about them, didn't they? They brought joy wherever they went, Ramon.
But they gave us our future.
Well, that's right. In many ways, they did. And then they left their scars along the way, too. But there's no complaining about it. We are what we are. What would we have been had we not had this harshness? We would have been like a ball of like a vanilla ice cream in a hot day.
Mush. We'd be mush.
Mush, 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 mush. Okay, Honolulu, Mike, KHBZ. I got to get out there someday and do KHBZ out of Honolulu. Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
One of my favorite stories, Dr. Savage, is your dog dying when you're younger. Not because I find it funny, but just because we've all gone through that, and that's just the reality of life. You waking up in the morning, and there's the dog stiff. Rigor mortis is set in, poking it with a broom. They call the sanitation department. You come up to your apartment. I mean, somebody that's been a part of your life, as a member of the family, and here you wake up one morning, here's reality slapping you in the face. I mean...
Yeah, and they threw him in. No, it was horrible. I don't know that they do that anymore today. He was a chow that must have weighed... He was part chow, weighed about 40 pounds. Now, this is the dog who had bit me when I was a kid. So I loved him because I was a kid and, you know, blah, 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 but I still was afraid of him because this dog was crazy. You know, he dug into my foot down to the bone. You could see the white showing when he bit me. I never trusted him after that. Nevertheless, when he died, it was a shock. My mother was crying. She was a sentimental, warm woman. And I said, "What's the matter, Mom? What's the matter?" And she said, "Well, the dog is laying there." She was frightened, you know. And I went over and we touched it, and it was stiff as a, like stiff. So she called the garbage department in San Francisco, the New York Sanitation Department. They two guys come in the brown uniforms, grim-faced. And they just nod. They took it out by the legs. And then bingo, in the back of the truck with the grinder going. I mean, that was horrible. They don't do that today, do they?
No, but that's life. I mean, we see sense.
All right, we don't throw a dog even in a garbage truck anymore today, do we?
No, I don't think so.
No, but it was. I tell you, it's a symbol of the kind of times in this country in a way. Grim, it was like grim. It's like Grimm's fairy tales in those days. And I'm not talking about 1,000 years ago here. You know, it's funny. I went on Google Earth the other day. And you know that I was the first to warn about the dangers of Google Earth, blah, blah, blah. So I went on the other day anyway, and I looked up all the addresses I had lived at in my life. I zoomed into the house I grew up in Queens. You know, it's astounding. I call it Google Eye. When I go on Google Earth for more than like a certain period of time, I get Google Eye. You can write that down. I created it for you so it could be stolen tomorrow by Newt Gingrich. Anyway, I got Google Eye. What's shocking about it is it almost takes away all the mystery of heaven and earth. You're sitting up in heaven and look down and zoom down to New York or wherever you grew up and focus in on your little house. And boom, there you are in the heart of 18 million souls in the greater metro area. And there's your, and you go in and there's your little house, the exact street. I couldn't believe it. It's still there. And the porch my father built in the back of this attached little house is seen on Google Earth. I said, Dad's porch that he built with his own hands. I'll never forget when he built that. I was so impressed that he could build this. He had an Italian friend who was in the construction business who poured the foundation for him. And they came over. I don't know how they did it with Sacrete in those days. It wasn't even a truck. But they put out the wood platform. Now, I thought it was like a miracle to me. Then they poured in the cement. Then they put in the – before they put the cement, I thought that they were – I thought they were geniuses that they could figure out that in advance of pouring the cement, they were so smart, they had to put the screws in that were going to support the 2x4s that were the foundation. I said, man, my father is smart that he knew to do that. You know, you got to understand, kids don't see the world the way we do. They see the world as it is. Your father was smart if he could do a thing like that. So he lay, and it's still there. 1,000 years later, the porch is still there in the back of this house on Google Earth. That's why I got Google Eye.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin, the moment you come into view.
It is the Savage Nation. If you're expecting Democrats bad, Republicans good, you may as well tune into the guy with the voice of Groucho Marx, who thinks that everybody who calls him is a great American, because I'm going to tell stories right now. And, you know, please try to do this for me. It's amazing. I go to people and say, oh, tell me the story about this or that, because they heard it, they loved it, or they went through it themselves, and it brings back a different time in America, whatever. I can't tell all these stories in a movie. You know, what would be the point? And it's going to end up with me sitting somewhere, or actually me on the radio in front of a microphone, doing a live show like now, and then flashing back to telling these stories of how I got here. I don't want to give away the whole story of how I'm going to do it. I think you're going to love this movie when it's out. It's a long way from being made. But the baby, let's put it to you this way. The baby is a glint in its father's eye. That's what it is right now. That's all this baby is a glint in its father's eye. But it's not going to be aborted, I tell you right now. WOR in New York, Karen, you're on the Savage Nation. Which story do you want to hear?
I have to hear it. The one when you went into the shoe store and you placed your foot in the x-ray machine. That story.
Okay, wait. Now, I have a dentist who said to me he did it too. Why do you remember? Why is that story good fun for you?
I don't know. It's hysterical. The way you tell it, you can picture it. It's wonderful. And
well, what's shocking is that I'm not dead from it, because I would press the button over and over and over to see the it was like, you know, Halloween come alive for me, Karen. Now, by today's analysis, shouldn't I be dead from cancer of the foot?
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Did I ever tell you about the nun's trunk? Now, many of you have heard the nun's trunk story, but many of you didn't. I'll tell you the story, because it's a wild and true story that has tragedy and some comedy. Now, Dad was a secondhand dealer and an antique dealer. They call it antiques then. I wouldn't call them antiquities of the high order, but some of them were beautiful pieces, so I learned a little bit about quality. I could tell the difference between Doré bronze and white metal. I could tell the difference between a schlock artist and a real artist. I could tell the difference between a velvet painter, you know, and things like that. If you're around art, you eventually learn what art is and what an artist is and how hard it is to really do a proper sculpting and a proper painting, particularly if you're a kid when your eyes are very sharp and you have nothing but hours on your hand while you're cleaning things to stare at various art objects. You eventually learn which piece is good and which piece is bad, particularly if you have a sense of the differential in your own mind. But one of the things Dad did in the early days in his business was buy trunks at auction. They were called subway auctions. They don't have them anymore. What that meant was if people left valises or trunks or suitcases on the subway, they were taken to a warehouse, and a couple of times a year they would have what's called a subway auction. And the men like my father, who were poor merchants, would go, and they would bid on the suitcase based on what the suitcase's quality was. They would bid $3 to $8 to $10. They didn't know what was going to be in there. But naturally, if it was a better suitcase, they figured they might find something of quality. So they took a chance. It was in those days, they didn't open them. In other words, well, you wouldn't auction something off in a suitcase if you knew what was in it. And they didn't go through them. So they would buy at auction trunks and suitcases that were abandoned on the subway, God knows for what reason. And the fun was coming back into the marketplace late at night with a truck full of these suitcases and valises that were unopened. And it was like a giant thrill for a kid to be there as the guys tore open the suitcases and started finding, hey, look what, you know, one guy, look what's in here, some silver plated this. Oh, look what I found here. Look at this, it's a gold watch. So while one of these auctions, they're opening it up, and they can tell, you know, you don't dump it all out on the floor. You take it out piece by piece. You don't know what you're going to break if you throw it over. They didn't have any respect for it necessarily. They're afraid of breaking something. So they're opening a trunk. It was a steamer trunk. In those days, there were steamer trunks. People traveled on ships in steamer trunks. And this one apparently belonged to a nun. How did they know it belonged to a nun? Simple. It had a nun's habits in it. So naturally now, therefore, it had some religious context. And the men treated it with a little more distance and a little more respect. They figured maybe they'd find a religious object, and they didn't want to violate any religion by dropping something. So they're going very slowly and pulling the things out little by little, and this is nothing of real value. You see her pictures before she was a nun, a regular girl. Then God knows what happened in her life that made her heart broken, and she went to a nunnery then, and she is in the habit. Then you see letters from the mother that dwindle out, and there's no letters. And then you can't believe what you can find in it, the stories that I would see as a kid. So they get to the bottom, and there's some cloth wrapped around something, like what you'd call Muslim, and I don't mean the religion, Muslim, you know, like Muslim cloth, like cheesecloth in essence. And the cheesecloth was wrapped around an object, and a lot of it. So they started to unwrap it. They were unwrapping and unwrapping, like a spool, unwrapping, and on the bottom of the spool of the nun's trunk was an embryo. Apparently this girl had become pregnant. She did not want to, she became pregnant, and she probably had an abortion, is what I'm saying. It so broke her heart, she felt that she had killed something, that she took the fetus, wrapped it up in this cloth, put it in the trunk, and that was her secret. The story of a fetus in a nun's trunk, it's exactly what I saw as a kid. There are others. There are others. I spend hours down there, as I told you, cleaning down in the dark, horrible Dickens basement, unheated in the winter, unrefrigerated in the summer, and use the cyanide solution to clean the patina off bronzes. So I would get bored to death And in between cleaning sometimes, there were these huge wine barrels that they used for waste, not like wet waste, but the stuff that they take out of the trunks and they didn't want, they'd throw in there, you know, the dry waste. And in these huge wine barrels. And I remember you could smell the wine, how strong it was, the barrels, the big kegs. I'm talking big. They were as big as me with hoops around them. And they smelled of the wine and they smelled of the wood. I could smell it to this day. So I'm down there, and I was a kid who was always curious. I would start going through the throwaway stuff because I found it very interesting. What was in the barrel? You'd find pictures, little black and white pictures or manuscripts. I swear to God, I saw compositions, paintings. You don't know what people... See, these guys threw them out. To them, there was no value inherent in a man's life. All that was of value was what was to them what he could sell in the market. But to me, as a kid, I saw the value in the man's life story. So I'm digging through the thing, and I would get hung up on a guy's pictures. And there it was again, a whole life story thrown in a barrel. Here he was in the streets of New York, average guy, suit and this and that. Then you see him on the ship waving goodbye. Then he's in Paris somewhere or in London, I don't know where. And then suddenly he doesn't look so hot. And then at the end of it, it peters out. He looks like a bum somewhere. I don't know, the last picture taken of him, he's like a bum. And mixed in with that are some music compositions that this guy tried to write and sell and went nowhere. Now, whether he committed suicide, I can't tell you. All I know is that his whole life to me was seen in those black and white photos and his music compositions and some letters and this and that. So I always had an eye for the pathos of human existence and for the tragicomedy, which is why when I was a little boy, my favorite gift given to me by mom was a pair of thespian cufflinks where one was smiling and one was frowning. And very often in school, I would sit there bored out of my gourd, and I would stare at the happy face on my right cufflink of the happy face, and on the left arm, on left sleeve, there was the sad face. And then when the class got so boring, I thought I would tear the hair out of my arm, I would take the left cufflink and put it on my right sleeve and put the right cufflink on my left sleeve, which today, of course, they would call obsessive compulsive disorder with prejudice. And they put me on 75 drugs and turned me into an accountant. But luckily, I grew up when they didn't do that to people with an imagination and a soul.
Savage.
I'm cutting into storytelling time. I don't know who to take. I don't know which person to take here. I'm going to take somebody, this body, that body, da-da-da. So I don't know what to take. Here, we go to this one. Los Angeles, Kevin. Go ahead, please. Which story would you like me to tell?
Michael, my favorite story of yours is when you're a kid in your father's antique shop. And you're standing in there, and a normal Joe walks in. I forgot what kind of guy he was. And he didn't look like anybody, you know, prestigious. And your father treated him like a king. And you didn't expect him to buy anything. And the guy ended up buying, like, a bunch of valuable pieces. And he walked out spending a ton of money.
Yep.
And your father looked at you, and he said, "Let this be a lesson to you, Michael. You treat everyone with respect like they're a king because you never know who they are."
You got it 100% right. He was a black man from South Carolina or North Carolina who owned an antique store himself who would come to my father's store to try to buy these. To him, it was a wholesale buy, even though my father wasn't a wholesaler, because he could take them down there and sell them for a lot more in the South. And he had very good taste, as my father did, in the statues that he had picked from the importers. But I'll never forget, you know, you'd figure, oh, in those days, all the white men were prejudiced towards black. The opposite was true. There was less prejudice then than there is now because of the civil rights movement and the loudmouths like High Jackson and the Reverend Sharpton. They have provoked more racial hatred and enmity in this country than any two people before them, as far as I could tell. But that's my opinion. The fact of the matter is, this black man came in the store, and not one man in there was anything but a white man in the selling. And rarely did you see black folks in the store in those days. We didn't know him from a hole in the wall. But my father treated him with dignity. He didn't know who he was, and he said, "Well, how much is that, and how much?" And they spoke very nicely to each other. The man didn't chisel him either, by the way. He just took out a pen, and he wrote down what he said. Okay, boy with harp, girl with banjo, man with horse, you know, like that. 700, 800, 900. He said, "All right, I'll take all 17 of them." He virtually took out the entire inventory of what my father had in front, which for him was amazing because he made the month's nut, you know. There were months went by that he didn't sell very much in there. I can tell you about those days, another story. But the truth is, there is a moral to the story, which was a boy learning from his father, irrespective of whether you did it for any reason other than for commercial reasons, which is to treat every man with respect, because that's the way you want to be treated. Thank you. Thank you for remembering that. I forgot that story. I remember those days. You know, how about the jinx? I don't know if you're a merchant with stores. There's very few people left that we even have a store anymore. Everyone has a business, a this, a home business, an internet, and that. But if you have a store, a retail store, I don't know if it still goes on. So you'd have merchandise up there, you know, small store. And sometimes weeks would go by, he wouldn't sell an item. Now, I got to tell you, when you're living on the proceeds of buying and selling in a little store and you have no government handout, there's no safety net. It gets pretty frightening for the principal breadwinner. There was mother didn't work. We didn't work. We were in school. And he'd go by, and it would be week in and week out. I remember sometimes a lull, like hitting a water, like no wind in the water in a sailboat. And sometimes he would say to me, I got to break the jinx. I got to break the jinx. I said, well, how are you going to break the jinx? So if a guy would come in or a woman would come in to buy something from him, he'd cut the price down to a level that below what he paid for it. And I'd say, Dad, why did you sell that clock for less than what you paid? He said, I had to break the ice.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Chris, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, it's an honor. I just wanted to say that, man, when you tell your stories, especially about the one where all the women in the kitchen gossiping, I always think of that reminds me of, like, kind of my youth, too. Like, everything was okay, you know, when you could hear them in the background. You're a kid. It's almost like Brighton Beach Memoirs. You can, like... It's like you can feel like the family, even though they beat you up emotionally, but you just feel like everything's okay in the world when they're back there gossiping and you can hear them. I love that story that you told about that.
But which, you like the women in the kitchen better or the men on the couch with the pants open gagging? No, look, that's the way people fed in those days. Today, I don't think they do unless they're ethnic groups who eat like that still. They still do that. I mean, I miss it in a way. If you left my mother's house and you were hungry, it was considered a sign of that she mistreated you. Do you understand how they thought?
Oh, absolutely. Like you always said that you know, nobody made calls saying I'm going to come by. We need to make
no. Time. Nobody called and said they came over and knocked on the door. Almost every night, relatives or friends would drop in on my parents. Today. In the world I live in, you never see anybody. You have to make 80 appointments with people, and by the time it comes around, you don't want to see them anyway. You know, it's like you went through it in your head 100 times.
I know it. I love it.
No, it's true. I like that spontaneous, but the neighborhoods were different. They all live together, and I have a friend. Well, he's dead now. He just recently passed away, but his parents, excuse me, had come over from the old country. The father was a butcher. And they moved into an area in Queens, not near us. They didn't know our family at all. But when they left Queens to move to Florida, which they all did, it was like the elephant's burial grounds. Not only did they move to this area of Florida, their entire neighborhood moved at the same time within a few months of each other to the same exact retirement area or community in Florida. They transported their entire neighborhood. I said, you know something? Those people had a much richer life than I do. I got to tell you that right now. I envied that. None of them had real money. No one had any in the fame. I really envy what they had. They had a unity and a community that you can't even match today. And I'll tell you something more interesting. Jamaican communities of black Jamaicans in Queens, New York, you know, tend to live together like many ethnic groups do. Do you know that when they retired, I read this a couple of years ago in a paper, when the Jamaicans, the people from Jamaica, came to Queens and lived there, worked their lives, bought that, blah, 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 the kids grew up, they moved their entire community at the same time to the same retirement area, and I think it was also wherever it was in Florida, but as a community. And this goes on with many ethnic groups. They had a lot going for them. They had a community that the left likes to talk about that they could never find, and frankly, that I talk about, and I do find on this show. You got to understand something. Because I live in the most horrible community on planet Earth, the sickest people on the planet live in San Francisco. Bar none, there's no sicker community than San Francisco. I would wage a bet that there's no more morally debased city in the entire world than this city. You name the country, and I'll tell you there's no city worse than this. And I'll prove it to you. Last Friday, this city took a transsexual who owns a porno shop and made her, him, whatever, the police commissioner. This was the final straw for me and many people I know who they said they're getting out of the city as soon as they can. They're selling their houses as soon as they can and they're leaving. It is the most debased city on the planet. And I got to tell you something. One of the reasons I created this radio show was because I could never find a community to live in where I felt that I could find like-minded people. I got to tell you that right now. You say, well, what motivates a man to create a thing in his own mind, a radio show, and go on the air every day and people call and listen, millions of people, because we live in an atomized world where you probably feel disconnected from a community of like-minded people where you can talk with and this. And you wish to God that, let's say, don't you wish that you could come, like go out tonight, let's say after work, come home and go out of your house and go to a meeting hall where I would be and people like the ones you hear calling the show would be, sit around, talk a little bit. Of course you do, but you can't find that in this world. So you come to talk radio for the community you can't find in the world in which we all live. And that's what I'm getting at, is that I could not find that world. I can't find that world. So I created that virtual world through this radio show. Do you understand where I'm coming from?
Savage.
1-800-449-8255. I hope you're enjoying the show anywhere in America today. WTNT in Washington, D.C. Gary, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Dr. Savage, you're a true orator, man, from like centuries and stuff. Yeah, I love adages, and I can identify. I don't think there's a bad story you've ever told, man. It's cool.
Well, I do. I have a storyteller's gift, and every one of them is real. Every one of them is real. Is not one made up. I don't know how to make up a story, which is why I was never a fiction writer, Gary.
Doctor, what I was talking about is that I love all the stories, and the one that resonates the most with me, 12 years in the Marine Corps, all the different stuff I've done, I had, different things in life. But if you could relate some of the Fiji Alzheimer's stuff, as well as like how you got turned on to IF, because I use that with my kids. And
By Rudyard Kipling?
I mean, I could talk to you about a myriad of things, but that
No, wait. Go back to something you said a minute ago. I don't want to dismiss anything you said. You said the Fiji Alzheimer's thing. What do you mean by that? You mean how I was researching ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and in New Guinea and all of that, and how that led to my work in the Alzheimer's field, all of that. So it's an interesting – I never talk about the years I spent doing research, never. I never talk about it, Gary, because I assume people aren't interested.
With that, so it means –
Yeah. Well, but let's talk about the kids and the poem IF. It's a great poem to raise children with. I mean, they don't have a lot of time and a lot of attention span with all of the imagery coming at them and all of the distractions in our society. It's a life-giving poem. Do you remember any of the stanzas from it?
Well, just the one that if you can walk with kings, but speak to have a common touch.
That's the one. An older man said that to me when I was like 20, 21. He said you ought to look into the poem IF. He said it goes like this, and he remembered one stanza. If you can walk with kings and never lose the common touch, then you'll be a man, my son. And that came to be true. You know, I think that's what you're saying, which is never lose the common touch.
And it's basically a guide for how to guide them in their life. Today's world is so degraded. I mean, that's why.
My God! Well, it's not only degraded in the world of human beings, but it's degraded with our culture. Look at the cultural references. When you turn on a TV or you turn on the internet, are there any cultural references to great literature or great music or great poetry or great scientists or great artists? Nothing. It's all debased garbage. Every reference is to a debased, degraded human being or a human being's production. Every reference is a degradation.
Yes, sir.
It is. It's rotting out the mind of the West. Now, I cannot do stories every day. You got to understand there's only so many stories, and you can't do this all the time. If I did 1 hour of radio a week, I'd have a humongous audience. But I guess you can't monetize a show like that, these single shows. They don't work. There's no money in them. That's the end of this hour on the Savage Nation. I've really enjoyed it tremendously. Foot X-ray machine, the fetus in a nun's trunk, mom cooking, Philip Morris, dad on a couch, the two cufflinks, sad and happy, black buyer and dad shop, and many, many other stories. Hopefully there'll be many, many stories to come. With God's will and your listenership, you shall return to the Savage Nation.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, look, I'm on the road to a confidential location. I will be back on the air very soon, but today is a day to celebrate our triumph over evil. Some of the excellent articles that are appearing right now on MichaelSavage.com, some of the most brilliant minds of our generation, are now writing on various blogs, and I am finding them and linking them for your own edification. Please read them. I'll be back very shortly from a new location.
Savage.
Now we got the email chain is on my website, or am I on my email already with the family? We're talking vacation. 500 emails. Where to go, where not to go. I want to go, I don't want to go. I can't go then, I will go then, I won't go then. So now it's down to this already. It's a ship again. I swore I'd never go on a ship again, except my own ship, because every ship I've been on, I got either food poisoning or try to get a helicopter to remove me after 48 hours. The last ship I was on, I begged the owner. I said, "You got to cable the owner and tell him I'll pay for a helicopter to get me off the dreadful nightmare." I called it what did I call it at the time? I said it was a trailer park with propellers. I never saw anything like this. What was the name of that cruise line? They got me the owner's cabin. You hear this? Did you hear this story years ago? I went on this ship. It was like a 2-dayer. After 12 hours, I was begging him to take me off by helicopter. They put me in the owner's cabin as far forward as you can get from the tattooed people jumping in the swimming pool, beating up their girlfriends, that kind of thing. And I'm in the owner's cabin, and above me, this is God's honest truth, they put me beneath a running track. Now, I'm noise sensitive. Why am I on a ship to rest or to listen to a moron running at 5 in the morning? Thump, 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 thump over my head 5 in the morning. The runners were running over the owner's cabin at 5 in the morning, so I couldn't sleep. Now you couldn't go to sleep because the owner's cabin was right in front of the swimming pool where I never saw anything like these creatures were jumping in the pool, dueling rollerballs and drunk and rum and cocktail. I never saw anything like this nightmare. So that was the last cruise. I don't think I'm going to do this. No. It starts out, yeah, we'll go, it'll be great. What am I going to do if I go in and I get a great cabin and the guy below me smokes a cigar? Why would he smoke a cigar? Because the moron's on a ship and he thinks he should smoke a cigar because he thinks he's rich. Because he bought a cabin for $1,299 instead of one for $699, so he thinks he's rich. And his wife made him rent a tuxedo, and she's not exactly wearing Nan Kemper's gowns. She's not exactly wearing haute couture. She's wearing low couture. And you got to see these creatures in the dining room. No, please. Why am I even thinking of this? I say to myself, that's it. It's over. I'm not going. I'm going to send that email the minute I get off the air. But I was thinking about, like, we have a new thing now. You know, the trend is bloggers, you know, and like every politician wants to go to bloggers. Why are they going to bloggers? How many people can read a blogger? What is a blogger? It's a guy sitting in a room writing a column on the internet. So let's say you have 10,000 readers of your blog. That's insignificant. When you consider that, in essence, a talk radio host is a verbal blogger, by the way, you want to put it in that context. But our audience is much larger. Moreover, we can use our voice and our emotion and sound effects and music to make our point, right? Different tones could create different feelings in the listener. But, you know, when you actually analyze what a blog is, you can go all the way back and you realize that the first blog were the Ten Commandments. You think about it. The guy walking around amongst the ancient Israelites, and he says, well, I was walking around on a mountain, and some guy up in the sky talked to me, and he says, Here's what he said to me. I wrote it down for you. Look, get out of here. I'm going to the cafe. I'm going to the cafe Golden Idol. You know what I mean, Moses? You want to talk about some guy up there? Go ahead. Leave me alone. I'm going to cafe Golden Idol. I'm going to have a drink. Okay, Moses? You want to come along? Come along. Otherwise, you know, leave the tablets at home. You know what I mean? Leave me alone. But that the first blog, when you think about it, were the Ten Commandments. It was a blog. And in the beginning, no one believed them. Guys are marching around. The only reason it's Ten Commandments, when in fact the Orthodox Jews know that there's 330-some-odd commandments, is because they can only carry around two big tablets. So they can put the first 10 on. Here's the 10, all right? You believe these, we got another 10. You believe those, we got another 300 for you. But who can carry around, you know, like, who can carry around 30 tablets? So Moses had one tablet at each army. One, 10 commandments here. Here's my blog. Thou shalt this, thou shalt that's God's. I'm not mocking God. I'm telling you that originally, think about it. If you actually analyze it like I do with psychological nudity, and I'm not afraid to take on a subject, whether it be the Dubai port steal or the Ten Commandments, analyze it. I mean, the analysis will lead you to the proper conclusion that the original blogger was Moses. He walked around. They thought he was nuts. Guy in the sky. Yeah, all right. Hey, maybe you need a dream. You know, you've been working a little too hard up there in that mountain with the sheep. You're going with this whack job idea. Someone up there wrote this down to you. What are you, crazy? I can't do any of the things I like to do. What are you, crazy? Everything I like to do is on that tablet saying it's not good. How could everything I do be bad? It's impossible, Moses. How could everything I like be wrong? Why should I be punished for everything I like to do, Moses? And so so in other words, in the beginning, his blog wasn't very popular. And it was the same with the Christians who tried to sell it to the Romans. They were, in essence, bloggers. And they said, why don't you listen to this? Throw them to the lions, man. We like sleeping with animals. We like, you know, running around with anything we want. There's no such thing as morality. We don't even know what it is. We're Romans, after all. So they threw them to the lions because they didn't want to hear the truth. And that's God's word. And the same thing now. The liberal barbarians are trying to throw the Christians to the lions in the same manner. They're saying, well, what your truth is not our truth. We like to sleep with who we want to sleep anytime we want. There's no morality. We could do it within a road. We could do it with children. Doesn't matter. Animals, doesn't matter. Whatever you want. So we're descending, in essence, back to the ancient Romans. And before long, we'll be back to the animal altogether. You like that little? That's not bad. That was like the original blog from there to now. Boom. History all in about 2 minutes. Created it for you on the spot. Now, I'm sure I made as many people unhappy as happy. Because stretching people's imaginations is a very dangerous thing in a world where there is increasingly less and less imagination and less tolerance because of the increasing number of pompous fools called liberals who think they know everything, when in fact I know everything. Lawrence, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
How you doing, Mike? I was listening to you about the cruise that you obviously have gone on a number of times. It sounds like a traditional cruise, which is you have to be in the same place every night for your dinner. And you should try the freestyle cruises where there's like 13 restaurants on a ship, no music in the elevators, no music on the promenade deck, and you can do whatever you want.
No, that sounds better. But have they updated the mentality of the ships to that extent?
Absolutely. The new cruise line ships, and I won't mention the name of the cruise line, but the ships are more geared to, you know, an older generation. You find a few children on the ship. And it's great.
Where can I find one with no children on the ship?
Probably.
No, I sound like Scrooge McDuck. I mean, the truth is I raise children. I love children. But why would I want to eat around children?
Exactly. February and March, there aren't any kids or children or even teenagers on the ships.
Oh, thank God. Yeah, the worst month to go on a ship is June. The college idiots are on the ship, drunk all night, puking in the hallways, throwing themselves into swimming pools in the most god-awful time of night, you know, music everywhere. So I got to find something like that where there's no – they can't say no children. They're not allowed anymore.
No, they don't say no children, but if you go a certain time of the year and you find that, like, when the kids are still in school –
Oh, thank God. Yeah, but then sometimes you get the grandparents because the daughter became crazy and had to take the kid away. You know, the daughter went mad. That kind of thing. She shaved her head and ran down Fifth Avenue because she didn't have shoes as good as Nan Kempner. I don't know, you know. Thanks. I'm trying to combine the elements. I remember years ago, when I was on a ship. Oh, God, this was a long time ago. This was like the Royal Viking Sea in the South Pacific, okay? Great cruising days. So There was an old guy. He was from L.A. Hairy chest, you know, like tan. Looked like a garment center guy. Very nice guy. Like a lifetime, you know, of killing himself. You know, just killing himself at work. So he says, all I do now, he says, I never leave a ship. He says, I'm on the ship all the time. I struck up a conversation. I was like the younger guy. You know, he was the older guy, and he liked me. I liked him. So he said, I cruise the world on a ship. I never get off a ship. He said, I go from one cruise to the other. He said, hey, it's cheaper than, you know, than an apartment. He had probably a big house in L.A., but he liked the ship. And he said, I've already given instructions to the cruise line and the captain that if I die, he's in a heart condition, he's, I'm going to get buried at sea. He said, I don't want anything. That's it. I die. They put me in the freezer. A quick prayer like a chicken in a slaughterhouse and boom, overboard. That's what he wanted. He figured this guy had it all figured out. You know, he figured he'd party the way he wanted to. Then they'd throw him overboard. You know, I don't know if I burial at sea. I'm not too sure about that one. That's hard to do because now, you know, the crabs that you don't even hit a crab for it. You don't even get that far. They throw you overboard. You're not hitting a crab for like 8,000 feet. You're being picked apart before your bones. Nice thought. Let's not go there. No skeletons. No skeletons tonight. Yeah, it's a quick dance in the sun. It's after many a summer dies the swan. There's no question about it. We're all in denial. We're denying the main question. We won't deal with the main question. It's theological as much as it is philosophical. But the fact is that we're all afraid of dying. And the more we're afraid, the more we party till all hours of the night. You know, pot of Ivia, dancing. Oh, I was up all night partying. Oh, great time, great sex, great guy, great sex, great guy. Party on, party. But they're all afraid. They're running from death. And because they're running from death, because they won't face God, they're going to run even further from death until eventually they get exhausted. And there's only one thing left at that point, which is God. They'll come down to it. That's what it comes down to for everybody at the end of the day. So you're lucky if you're born with a high consciousness when you're very young and you face these questions of death when you're young. Because if you face it when you're young and you go through despair when you're young, when you get older, it really doesn't bother you that much. You realize there's nothing you can do about it anyway. So try to live the best life you can. Don't hurt too many people. Don't let them hurt you by all means. But, you know, it's all about walking through that thing called life, which is a gigantic show. It's all a show. It's like a gigantic arcade. Life is a great arcade. You understand that? And on the left side, there are all sorts of exhibits down this one. This was told to me by a holy man about 25 years ago, and I went through this whole thing. So he said, you're walking down an arcade, and on the left side, there are exhibits. On the right side, there are exhibits, and there's little, you know, booths, and they're trying to pull you in. And there's a naked lady here, there's a naked man there, and there's a gambler here, and there's a drug guy selling drugs there, and there's a movie here. And your job is to keep walking down the straight and narrow and not be pulled into any one of those booths. You can look at them. You can understand it's there. You don't deny that they're there, but you don't get sucked into any one of those booths. You got to make that passage. It's a passage, you know, down life. I mean, that's it. Of course, you know, you're going to be attracted to the Cafe Golden Calf. I understand that. But you just don't get stuck in the Cafe Golden Path, and you don't drink to the point where you fall off the stool. You see, it's all this balance, the middle way. But youngsters can't do that unless you put them on Ritalin. Then they become instant heartless people without a soul. You get it? No? We move on.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. To an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
In the days of ancient Rome, emperors such as Septimus Severus would give unlimited free wheat to the poor. He would stage costly circus games in order to pacify the populace with food and entertainment. They realized then that bread and circuses were a good way of avoiding popular unrest. Today, not much has changed, except that we have more bread and better circuses. Across the United States, patriotism is dead. American industry is being gutted by globalists. But there is no outcry. American culture is destroyed by socialists, but its citizens are asleep. America's sovereignty is challenged by China, Iran, North Korea, and Mexico. But don't ask the average American to respond. They're watching Paris Hilton on TV. They're stuffing their fat faces with junk food, processed bread, electronic pornography. America is fat, sated, and silent. It is asleep. As long as Americans have their cheap food, America will slumber. As long as the flow of pornography continues over the cable systems, through the satellite receivers and internet connections, America will continue its long sleep. When Thanksgiving comes around this year, Americans will bow their heads not to God, but to tryptophan and football. Because whether it's Septimus Severus or George Bush or Nancy Pelosi, it doesn't really matter much. They all know that bread and circuses are the key to keeping you silent as America slowly slips into oblivion, becoming not a nation, but a trading partner. Now play some circus music, please, on the Savage Nation. Snap, snap.
Healthcare. Healthcare coming soon, says Hillary. Plenty of healthcare. Extra, extra. Dems bring healthcare. Don't fear the terrorists. They're moms and dads just like you.
I like this music. I always loved circuses as a kid. Afraid of the freaks. What can I say now they're running the show? You all know that. If I could just play this music and go home, I'd be happy. What do I have here in the news? Let's see this. Oh, here's a nice story from the World Tribune. Thank you. They got the circus theme. You can knock it off. One of the biggest problems in radio is that people have no sense of timing. Some guys, you turn on their show, they play music for minutes. You don't even know the song they're playing. In their head, they think they're being clever, like Billy Crystal at his best. You don't know what they're doing it for. I'm lucky. I was always good at entertainment. I always was. It's true I'm brilliant and very insightful and well-read and highly educated, but I'm also a good entertainer. I think my dog has an itching attack from watching Will Blitzer because he wants to see the man arrested for sedition and deported. Every time he sees one of these talk show guys on CNN, my dog starts to scratch.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I want you to start shouting like you're going at your man. Because if you give God a crazy praise.
What I want to talk about briefly are the black preachers of yesteryear, some of whom still exist, by the way, who are kept down by the white liberal establishment who were never heard from. The white liberal establishment who keeps the black community down and suppresses the family-oriented and God-oriented preachers are who I want to salute today on the Savage Nation. You are listening to the voice of Reverend Dr. Gregory Sutton. You heard the voice of strength, masculinity, wisdom, power, and righteous anger. Now, I want you to ask yourself a question. I want you to compare the black youth of today with the black youth of 40 years ago. Before the so-called Great Society, the great liberal society of Lyndon Baines Johnson with the Warren Liberal Court, tell me which generation is a healthier generation or was a healthier generation. Can you sit there and honestly say that this generation that has been turned away from God, turned to God knows what, to Ted Kennedy's company, Ted Kennedy and Company, saying you don't need a black father in the house and as a role model? What you need is Ted Kennedy and Company. The great white father will provide all for you through government. In liberalism, we trust. But before this, there were the black preachers keeping the people in believing, despite their great pain and humiliation of what the black people had gone through hundreds of years, the humiliation, the anger, and the suffering. And instead of channeling this into hatred and murder and violence, the preachers did, and some still do, channel it into goodness and to raising a family to the best of their abilities. And yet the white liberal masters, the Kennedys, the Kerrys, the Pelosis, who cast God out of the lives of the black people are replacing it forever with the worship of the state, the liberal state at that, saying that you only need us to help you. You can't help yourself. But listen to the preacher. I was driving in my car yesterday, and I happened to accidentally turn on one of the higher numbered stations, and I heard one of the preachers. Now, I had been infatuated with such preaching as a youth. I've been infatuated with a guy named Brother Billy, who I met down at 42nd Street and 8th Avenue one day, preaching on a soapbox. And I drove him up to his little storefront church in Harlem, and I went into this church, and I never felt... I'll tell you the truth. I mean, I've been in places of worship before. Rarely have I found or seen or been around a congregation so vibrant, let's put it to you that way, so vibrant, so vibrating with the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, as I did in that little storefront. Now you look at the Reverend Jackson, the Reverend Sharpton. They call themselves Reverend. Have you heard them use the name, the word God, in any of their preachings? Have you heard the great Reverend Jackson refer to Jesus or God in any of his preachings? And where does he preach, by the way, the great Reverend? And why do they refer to Sharpton as Reverend Sharpton on these shows? I can't believe the inauthenticity of these references. Why don't they ever refer to the real black preachers? Why don't they ever invite the real reverends, the Dr. Gregory Suttons, onto the television shows? I will tell you why. Because these men actually believe in the word of God. These men are opposed to homosexual marriage. These men are opposed to the liberal lifestyle. These men are in love with the family. 50 years ago, there were vibrant black businesses across America. Small businesses at that, but tens of thousands of them. And along came the liberal revolution of the 1960s. The black family was destroyed by many forces, not the least, though, of which was the liberal court of Earl Warren, the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson, and, of course, the fraudulent promises of Ted Kennedy and the other great white fathers. As a result, they were told, don't listen to that Uncle Tom preacher. Why, he's just preaching the white man's word to keep you enslaved. So let's see, they broke the chains of slavery of the preacher and of the church. And look at the black youth today. You're telling me they're better off not listening to the preacher, not controlling their anger, not controlling their rage, not trying to channel some of the internal strife and the internal energies into a positive manner? No, my friends, I got to tell you right now that it was the preachers who kept the black families together, taught them how to take that terrible pain that they had suffered and work with it and work it. And today, look where we are as a result of the white liberal who claims to be the best friend of the black man. And take a look at the children today as a result of them telling to turn away from the church. Now, this is not the most important story in the world, but it's an important story for me today because, as I said to you, I truly believe only the word of God can save not only the black community, but the white community as well. Why I'm looking at the black American community is only a product of my having heard the preacher on the radio yesterday and having heard some amazing, amazing preaching. That's all I can say to you. The man who said, if fear has entered a room in your mind, don't give him the keys to all the rooms in the house of your mind. Now, you say simplistic? But what about a person sitting in the audience who was touched and moved by that? Somebody who has been touched by some fear. Somebody who's been touched by some fear and is afraid that the fear will penetrate their entire soul. Now, who is going to lead them back? The doctor who gives them drugs? The jailer who gives them bars? The Reverend Sharpton who gives them bull crap? The Reverend Jackson who gives them a shakedown for himself, not for the guy who's suffering? No, my friend. It's not going to come from the liberal establishment. It's not going to come from the conservative establishment. It's not going to come from the Republican or the Democrat. It's not going to come from the talk shows. It's going to come from a turning back to the fundamental source of stability in the black community, and that was the Christian church. And by the way, it still exists. By the way, it's still vibrant. By the way, you don't know it's there because Hillary doesn't want you to see it. She doesn't want you to hear it. The truly black church, the true black church is there. It's still supporting a good many of the black people in this country. You never hear them. You never see them. You never hear from them. Why? Because they oppose the entire liberal agenda, primarily the homosexual agenda. And anything or anyone who gets in the way of the steamroller called the homosexual agenda becomes a nun person in this country. A nun person in this country. A persona non grata. I heard the preacher say to the audience yesterday, if you feel rejected, if you feel singled out, if you feel picked upon. He said, well, that's good because the founders of your religion were picked upon and rejected and ostracized by the people of their time. And the reason you're being picked upon and ostracized is because you're following the word of God. Now go to a step further. Have you heard the voice of Hillary Clinton as she steps into a black church, or Ted Kennedy, when they take on voices to try to sound like they're black? Listen to Hillary, for example.
I don't feel no ways tired. I come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy.
Now, I'm asking you, is this what you want leading on the United States of America? Now, I know no matter what I say here, 95% of black people will vote Democrat, just as 92% of Jews will vote Democrat. There's no way to change certain behaviors. No matter how intelligent people are, no matter how, who they become or what they become, they're stuck. They do what is right to be done in their own mind, which is what their grandfathers or grandmothers or fathers or mothers did. They're stuck in a pattern. So the person could be the biggest 14-carat phony in the world, and they're still going to vote for her. So I don't really care who you vote for. It doesn't matter to me who becomes president at this point. Today, at this time, in this segment, what I'm trying to talk about is preaching the word of God. Not me preaching the word of God, but how it has affected the black community in particular, and why that community has now descended amongst the youth particularly into a violent culture, a culture of drugs and guns and everything wrong that could ever be wrong with a society. It's all because the connection to God was broken by the great society, the white society of Ted Kennedy, the liberal society that promised the world if only they would turn away from the religion and the preacher and turn their lives over to the senator and the congressman from their community. Chicago, Preston, you're on the Savage Nation. Your opinion, please.
Yeah, I'm a black male calling from Chicago. And, you know, I don't think the type of preacher that you're promoting, or, you know, the one that you got on your show today, he's the type of preacher that we in the black community call a Negro preacher, because he's not teaching the true message of Jesus Christ. He's sitting around here raving and hollering, talking about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I mean, you're a smart man, Mr. Savage. You got a degree. You can't divide three into one. I mean, and first of all, I bet he has a white Jesus on his church wall anyway. And you know,
but where is the disagreement? You're saying because he is Catholic, you don't agree with him?
I'm saying that's part of it. That's part of it, because you study history and I do too. I'm not
Let me ask you. I'm not here to disagree or agree with you, Preston. Because are you a churchgoer yourself?
I don't go to church, but I read the Bible and the Quran.
All right. So you understand the and you haven't heard me bash Islam, have you? Not with regard to the blacks, because it's a separate story that I want to talk about eventually, which is that any religious movement or any religion that brings people off the streets and away from drugs, as far as I'm concerned, is a good religion.
Now, I'm not saying that Christianity is a bad religion, Dr. Savage, but if you go to the root of where Christianity was founded, we know that it came from Constantine, who was someone who was not really a Christian.
No, you're talking about Constantine the Roman. You're not talking about the foundation of Christianity. Constantine didn't create Christianity. Constantine tried to instill Christianity in the Roman.
Exactly. He's the one who called the Council of Nice, in which the bishops around the Roman Empire came
but
together.
But look, I don't want to get lost in history and lose what we're talking about. I believe that the perfidious nature of the liberal senator from Massachusetts, the perfidious nature of the false preacher, the deceit through the trust. In other words, when you say perfidious, what am I referring to? I don't want to use a big word. I never do. It means to deceive by trust. So the liberal says, trust me, and then they deceive you. You can't argue that the black youth of today is doing better having turned away from God, Preston. I don't believe you are saying that.
Oh, no, man, my community is destroyed, and they're destroyed because of a lack of knowledge. I mean, and I can't make no excuses for them. You know, I love black people. You know, every people love their own first, Dr. Savage. I'm not.
Amen. And you're an honest man for saying that. And your heart's probably broken when you walk and look at the wreckage around you, the human wreckage with pants hanging down underneath their behinds.
That's saw a guy like that today, and I told him, man, pull up your damn pants. Excuse me. I'm really for a law that you should be either fined or possibly if you get three strikes, you go.
No, I agree. I see white kids like that who I don't know, and I feel like saying, don't you have a father at home who's embarrassed by you? Walking around holding on to your pants like that? Like a jailhouse sissy who's just been molested?
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
You know, I open up the TV this morning. I woke up. I turn it on, and I had to turn it off. I got sick over the carnage in Iraq. Sick. The Sunnis set off bombs in the Shiite district in the university. Like 200 people, 94 dead right now, 194 wounded. That means there's 200 that are going to die. When you hear wounded, 194 wounded, you have any idea what kind of wounds they are? It's not you twisting your ankle while jogging in Marin County. We're talking about a lifetime of pain. Who sets it off? The Sunnis set it off in the Shiite district. Last week, the Shiites were involved in hanging Saddam. Now we see that there are millions of Iraqis who have left the country, mainly the middle class. Where are they going? They're flooding into Jordan. Where are they going? Well, you know what's coming, don't you? You know what's coming. After all, George Bush is a compassionate conservative. Emphasis on the first word and put a big X to the second. You mark Mike's words that rather than grant amnesty to the Marines who he falsely permitted to be crucified at Camp Pendleton for doing their job a little too well, by the way, not following Mr. Rogers' orders, and not granting amnesty to the Border Patrol agents who were in a shootout with drug dealers on the Mexican border who faced 20 years in prison because Bush will not give them amnesty, and that two-faced phony pimp, Tony Snow, says they didn't follow the law, they deserve to be in jail. Tony Snow makes me puke. That pancake make-up fraud from Fox News. Who does he think he's fooling? He's acting like a conservative? My dog's excrement is more of a conservative than Tony Snow. Pardon me for being so blunt. I don't have the time to mince words with you. We're way past the time of niceties. If you want niceties, you can turn on many, many other shows. If you want reality, you can turn on this show. Maybe reality's too much for you. I don't know. I know it's too much for corporate America. Corporate America is filled with cowards who want vanilla. They want vanilla talk show hosts. In fact, they don't even want talk radio. They want the ratings of talk radio without the talkers and without the content. They'd rather have nothing on the air. I suppose that they figure that there are more terrorists who can drive a Buick than there are conservatives. Because after all, Buick won't advertise on the Savage Nation. I suppose the Ford Motor Company assumes that there are more homosexuals in America than there are conservatives who used to drive Fords who won't drive them anymore. I don't know how many homosexuals and terrorists there can be in America, but it seems to me that the advertisers are betting on the terrorists buying a Buick or a Cadillac or a Ford because they seem to make sure that they don't advertise on the Savage Nation where only conservatives seem to conglomerate. But the fact of the matter is, and let me lay it on the line for you, I've done my homework. My audience, allegedly at 8 to 10 million, probably closer to 20 million, when you analyze the fact that many people are unrated, don't permit to be themselves to be rated at all, tend to demographically be upper-income people. Much more so than the audience, let's say, for hip-hop music, you know, hip-hop music. Great buyers, those hip-hop crowd. Can't imagine what they might buy tomorrow. So the demographics of my audience are quite good. They're the ones who actually buy the cars, have the mortgages, and buy all of the good products in this country. But the problem is the advertising agents seem to think that terrorists might buy the Ford. Or there are, let's say, I don't know, would they figure there's only, what, a few million of you and 100 million homosexuals who might buy a Ford motor car? And so they cater to the homosexual, the terrorist. Who else do they cater to? Oh, yes, the illegal alien might be a good demographic for them to cater to. Again, people with no money. It's unbelievable to me what's going on in my country. And so that's the reality that I live with every day. I have to balance this out every day that I get on the show. I have to analyze not what to say, meaning can I say it or not. I say it. But just how far I might go in delivering this sermon of truth on the Savage Nation. You know, this is not a HBO special. See, HBO won't have a special with Michael Savage either, even though I can probably get 10 times the audience of these verminous lesbian so-called comedians, these scummy left-wing comedians that they have on with no audience. I could probably get 10 times the audience on HBO or Showtime. After all, when I had my live event at the at Concord Pavilion, I had 7,000 paying customers. Natural for an HBO special. But because I wouldn't talk about things that are filthy, dirty, and perverted, the filthy, dirty perverts who run HBO and Showtime wouldn't have a conservative show on HBO or Showtime. Instead, they'll have a whacked-out psycho on HBO who talks about child molestation, the desire to rape his daughter, his impulses to do vile things to his children and wife. That's their idea of comedy, with a stooge audience in San Francisco and Los Angeles, sitting there, huck, huck, laugh, 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 laugh. That's their idea of television and radio, which is why the mainstream Muslim actually hates America, actually hates this society, because they know how filthy it really is. They don't actually hate the conservative in America. That's the funny part of it all. The mainstream Muslim would naturally hate, with his deepest core, hate the vermins in the vermin in the media, hate the liberal, because they know what a threat they are to their morality and the morality of their children. And so the natural allies in this country who have been divided from each other are the conservatives and the mainstream Muslims, not the radicals. But when have you last seen the conservative movement in America join together with the mainstream Muslims because their values are almost identical, particularly when it comes to family values? You've never seen that happen. Instead, you see these sick jerks on the radical left in cahoots with the radical Muslims in their desire to overturn and take down America, don't you? Some food for thought on this hungry afternoon here in San Francisco.
Savage.
So here I am, itching, the ears are itching, the eyes are itching, the face is red, everything's hurting. Reminds me of like the Moses story, you know. All right, I've chosen you to cross the red. I don't want to go, man. I don't want to do this. Why are you picking on me? My ear hurts. I'm a little hunch. I'm too old to lead the people across the red
sea. Savage.